Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we make another visit to Patrick's Book Nook.
Do we have music for this poll?
All right, Patrick, I see you have a stack of books.
I have a stack of actual books here, Jim, and I want to say one thing, before we jump into the books. Next time we do a Book Nook, what you'll hear right here is some custom Book Nook
theme. Oh, yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, I didn't get around to getting it together, man. I'm sorry.
But somebody sent some music for
somebody
us?
Somebody sent some music, and Mike Wagner also sent me four pieces of music that I could potentially choose from. And then earlier in the week, we heard Echo Park Jimmy threaten to do a Casio theme music for Book Nook. So maybe we should just have a different theme every time for Book Nook. How about that? The listeners can call in and we'll use a different one.
So what you want is like a jingle kind of thing, yeah, or some kind of theme music. The way that like Paul Schaefer would always have like a specific piece of music, right, for every Letterman bit,
you
right?
You have some music for this, Paul?
Yeah. That's right.
That's right.
Can we do this real quickly, yeah, before, just in place of that?
Yeah. Okay.
We did get an Echo Park Jimmy promo for our show.
Oh,
all
right.
It's not music, really. Okay. It's more of just like a promotion for our,
okay,
show.
We'll get people used to the fact that there will be theme music.
Yes. Yeah, I guess so. Let's listen to this. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenahan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And here's a promo for our show.
It's Echo Park Jimmy. Whenever I'm in the suburbs, every day, I make sure and listen to Rockin' the Suburbs with Jim Lenahan and Patrick Foster. Every day. A podcast guaranteed to rock the suburbs of your mind. Best of all, if a story or song sparks a vivid memory of your own, you can call up Jim and Patrick. Leave your own recollection, big or small, or as long as you want. 612-440-1984. Be like Cole Kishner, or like me, EPJ. Or even that Teller guy from Penn and Teller. Jim and Patrick don't care. They just want you to listen every day. What is math rock anyway?
There we go.
That was fantastic. Yeah. So short for EPJ.
And a lot of traffic going on in the background.
He was just waiting for a ride or something. Yeah.
All right.
That was beautiful.
All right.
But if you could get your Casio out next time, yeah, EPJ, that'd be sweet.
All right. So, okay. So let's get back on track here. So,
yeah. So it's book time.
So every once in a while you talk about recent rock books that you have read.
It's been a while.
I hope. Are we going through like six books here today?
Yeah, but we're going to go through them fast.
Okay. All right. Hit me.
Currently, Jim, I'm reading Bring It On Home, Peter Grant, Led Zeppelin, and Beyond, the story of rock's greatest manager by Mark Blake. Peter Grant, I'm about halfway through that book, and Peter Grant was a wrestler early on in his career. He did some things for Mickey Most and some driving, and he also had a hand in briefly managing Chuck Berry and Little Richard on the road,
wow,
in London. So, and then obviously he became the manager of Led Zeppelin, and that worked out pretty well with him. And, you know, I think if you know the movie Spinal Tap, that whole manager, you know, guy with the cricket bat was pretty much, you know, a parody of Peter Grant.
Is that
right? Smashing stuff. Yeah, for the most part. He was a huge man physically, you know, and won by intimidation pretty much every time. And if he couldn't win by intimidation, he would pay you until he won to protect his band. And, you know, he told Jimmy Page to take care of the music and he would take care of everything else. And that's pretty much how it worked.
How do we get a guy like that?
Yeah, I know. Seriously, we need somebody. I also want to say super thanks to J. Hunter Bennett from Dot Dash for the Prodigal Rogersham book. Go back and listen to the Dot Dash episodes and you'll hear Hunter talk about why he wrote this book. But it's a little volume and it's cool.
It's fills fantastic.
In, yeah, it's great, isn't it? It fills in a little part of punk rock history, around the Circle Jerk. Golden Age of LA Punk, 1979. Thanks again, Hunter, for bringing that. And it's a really fun read. So I encourage everyone to pick that up. I want to thank the super nice people at whoever published this book, the Capo Books.
Oh, yeah.
They sent me a copy of this book.
They do great stuff.
Uh-huh. The Closer You Are, The Story of Robert Pollard and Guided by Voices by Matthew Cutter. It's a really interesting book, Jim, that focuses a lot on Robert Pollard's creations that, you know, obviously any book about Robert Pollard's going to have a lot of stuff about Guided by Voices, right? But it also talks about a lot of the early history of the band and how he would make these, you know, albums with fake names and song titles, you know, that didn't have music with them, and just how he constantly was creating and his creative process and what he, you know, how his solo career came out and some of the inside stuff. And he completely cooperated for that book. So it's kind of the authorized, you know, biography of Robert Pollard up to this point. And it's really fascinating and very Midwestern and Dayton. You know, it's just kind of a cool story, the way it all started out, how they suddenly blew up when nobody was paying attention to them for like 8 years or something like that. So it's great.
Yeah. So DeCapo Press, they published that John Doe book.
Oh, that's right. I have that around here somewhere too.
Under the Big Black Sun, Personal History of LA Punk.
Right. So. With Watt, did a lot with that and a lot of those tales. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Great stuff. So I want to say one thing about Robert Pollard.
Uh-huh.
And I sort of like half jokingly tweeted this out, listening some of his stuff that he just released. But I'm really not joking. I'm really actually kind of not joking about this. Do you know the concept of a jukebox musical?
I do.
Do you know what that is? Mm-hmm. Where you take an artist's songs and then you sort of like write a story around that, and then the songs just become the music in the musical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking,
like Moving Out.
Yeah, there you go. That would be one of them, right? But like Mamma Mia would probably be the most famous of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, with all the music that Robert Pollard has written,
oh dude,
you could go through and you could craft a story of something or somebody or whatever, and make the music fit into it.
I love that,
and we should do that.
Yeah,
that should be our next project.
Yeah, and if somebody out there does it before us,
that's right.
You heard it here first. We're gonna come after you.
Be great.
I wanna thank Mike G.R. Atano at DeCapo for sending me that book.
That's wonderful.
It's really nice.
Okay.
Speaking of gifts, you, Jim, were kind enough to give me this book here, Slow Hand, The Life and Music of Eric Clapton by Philip Norman. He's written a whole bunch of books. He wrote one on the Beatles years ago that's good. And this kind of tells the whole story of Clapton, good, bad, and the ugly. Gosh, it's a really interesting book. I got to say, with all honesty, I didn't come away feeling particularly empathetic toward Eric Clapton, although he obviously suffered a terrible tragedy in his life that no parent should have to live through. But, you know, there's a lot to this whole, that whole story. And he was, you know, obviously a very sort of self-absorbed. That's the impression I get.
But that might make it a good book, right? I mean,
it's a really interesting read.
You know?
Yeah, you buzz right through it and it's really fascinating.
It's not all positive about
him. No, not at all. Many of his ex relationships are interviewed in that book, and you get the whole story. It's by no means sanitized in any way, so definitely worth a read. And thank you, Jim, for sending that my way. I want to point this book out that I checked out from the library, and I'll talk about the library in 1 second. This is a book called The History of Rock and Roll by Ed Ward, volume 1, 1920 to 1963. Now, you would think this book would be like 10 times as big, but what's fascinating about this book, Jim, I encourage people to read it. He really condenses the story of rock and roll. And right at the beginning, he says, this is not a completely super detailed history, but he takes all the really important moments and weaves it together in a tapestry. And it leaves you with plenty of places to go do further research on your own, which I think is great. So, you know, the whole Elvis story, all that stuff, maybe it's down to 2 or 3 pages, right? But he really gets it in fast. And he also does an amazing job of showing what else was happening at that same time. It's broken down into chapters by year, for the most part.
I knew I recognized his name because
he's a well-known writer, yeah.
Yeah, and he was co-author of a book I have, which is Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, that came out in the early 80s, and I have that book.
He wrote a lot for Rolling Stone. I think he was a record reviews editor for years.
So I find this interesting that volume one goes from 1920 to 1963. So you're talking about,
what do you think the end of the first chapter? Well, yeah, we all know.
Right, exactly. But it starts like way before anything we would think of as rock and roll.
And that's one of the most interesting things about it is that early stuff to me. If you think that sort of Rocket 88 was like the first rock and roll song, this book will completely change your mind that debate is wide open to be a lot of and a lot of things had to happen the right way for it all to come together.
I recently read a really good column that says that perhaps Good Rockin' Tonight was the first true rock and roll song. So there's a lot of debate on that. Yes. But my point being that you're going from a time before anyone considers the true sort of start of rock and roll and going up to the Beatles, which to most people is actually the real start of rock and roll. You know, it's sort of like how the NFL is divided between like the pre Super Bowl era and the post Super Bowl era. Like, you know what I mean? Like that's
right.
Really?
No, you're exactly right.
How it all got crystallized. Really it became.
Yeah. After the merger. Yeah, totally exactly. True. And the main reason I got a library card, Jim, is because I asked for this book for Christmas and nobody got it for me. The Beastie Boys book.
Riding on a thought. See where it's from. Grinding to a memory of a time yet to come. Smoke paints the air. Swirling images through my mind. Like a whirlpool spin beginning to unwind. And I stand at the edge. Cautiously awaiting. Carefully navigating by the stars in the sky. And I sit, and think to myself, and on the horizon line, the sunlight begins to climb.
Saw that Mary Riley Stiles Public Library had a copy of it brand new. I'm the first person that checked it out. I'm going to just keep renewing this bad boy. It's a fascinating book. It's really what it serves as is a great tribute to Adam Yauch, MCA, who's no longer with us.
Right, and, rest in power.
Yeah, you know, the other guys do an amazing job of remembering him, and there's so many great pictures in here, and I mean, they had so much fun while they were doing this band, you know? I mean, what an incredible band. Now, here's something I bookmarked, Jim. Adam Horovitz, right here, made a Toyota Corolla mixtape, and he's got all the songs listed here in the book. Back in 1991, my girlfriend, Ione, had a really beat-up burgundy Toyota Corolla. We went to a lot of places, had some weird and fun times together in that car. So here's a mixtape he made. It had a lot of Lee Scratch Perry in it, Bob Marley and the Wailers, Willie Bobo, Professor and the Efficiency Experts. Just a really cool mix. The Humpty Dance is on there. So it's a great trip through the Beastie Boys history up until the point where they got really famous. And, you know, there's a bunch of people that weigh in. And also, look how visually beautiful it is. I don't know if you've looked at it, but there's a map of Brooklyn.
No, I haven't seen this book yet.
It's fantastic. If you want it at the library, you're going to have to reserve it. I know.
That's a heavy book.
I might even have to buy it. It's such a lovely thing to have and just so visually powerful. Mm. You know, there's a recipe in there from a chef for one potato chip.
So I open it up right to this picture where they're with like Run DMC.
Isn't that an amazing picture? There's so many great pictures in there. If you like the band at all, and certainly they're an American institution, I would get that as soon as possible.
I need to get this. I really, now that I've actually seen it, I really have to get this book.
Isn't it cool? It's really, really amazing.
Yeah. All right.
And it's a hefty sucker too. But yeah, I want to talk about this book. It's called Bad Moon Rising, The Unauthorized History of Creedence Clearwater Revival. It was written in 2007 by Hank Bordowitz. And the reason I have it is because I signed up for Kindle Unlimited, which is $9 a month. I was buying so many Kindle books that I figured I would pay for it, you know, and there's a lot of weird stuff in there. And it's, you know, it's not all your prime stuff. It's kind of like, you know, the cutout bin. It takes a while for stuff to drift down to it. But this was a great book. One of the most interesting, fascinating stories in rock and roll. Jim, over 4 years, CCR released 7 albums that contain some of the greatest rock and roll music in the history of rock and roll in an unbroken string of singles that were all top 5, number 1, top 10. And John Fogerty wrote all of those songs.
Right.
And yet, here was a band that struggled. They were called the Gollywogs for a while. They played around clubs, you know, in the Bay Area and just struggled to try to make it. And finally, when he turned to this amalgam of bayou, swamp, rock and roll, and soul music and hit upon this magical formula with Proud Mary, and they were suddenly off and running, and he sang like an old blues guy. People that heard them early on didn't know if he was black or white.
Right.
And they came from the wrong side of the Bay Area. So at the same time, the Grateful Dead and all the hippies were, you know, going on this trip, there was this blue collar dressed in denim, working class rock and roll band on the other side of the track right. saying, "It ain't me. I'm not a fortunate son," you
the
know.
The plaid flannel shirts.
Yeah. It all comes apart in the most terrible way. You know, their last album, Mardi Gras, basically John Fogerty refused to write more than two songs for it because the other members of the band were upset at him at one point because they wanted some of their songs on the record too. And he said, "If you want them, you write them. And I'll write two songs for this record. And I want you guys to carry some of the weight." And he was, you know, he was a very much a control freak throughout this whole book. It's not a pleasant picture of John Fogerty in many ways. And then he has a terrible legal battle with Saul Zahnz, who owned Fantasy Records, and they signed a bad contract. You know, for almost 20 years, John Fogerty wouldn't play any of the Creedence songs in public because he knew the money would go to Zahnz.
Right.
And the only time he changed that decision was he played a benefit for Vietnam veterans at Washington, D.C. at some point, and he came out, started right into Born on the Bayou and went into Fortunate Son, and the people in the audience could not believe it because it's been 20 years since he actually played this song. People were like running down the hills and like, you know, going berserk, and he played a whole set of Creedence songs for those people. But his music was so important to the people in Vietnam that were fighting that war because it was direct and honest, and it was from the people who got drafted and not the people that dodged the draft, you know, like our current president or many people who had connections to do so. So, and then he just was entangled in this terrible legal battle. You and I talked about this, I think, once off mic. He was once sued over a song that he wrote.
Right.
That's how bad it got.
Sued for plagiarizing himself.
Plagiarizing a song he wrote.
Yeah, right.
It's got to be a unique case in the history of rock and roll. And then he comes around with Center Field, and it's a whole comeback in the mid-80s. And now he's, you know, he's been out there for the last 20 years, 30 years out there kind of doing his thing. Yeah. And he still plays. And it's an amazing book.
I think he's an amazing artist. Yeah. So I definitely want to check out this book.
Did you ever see Fogerty play?
I did.
Yeah.
It was just a few years ago. I saw him at Wolf Trap. Yeah. And he was still great. And he was probably like 70 years old. And he was still
unbelievable.
Great.
Yeah. It really is unbelievable.
And one thing couple things I love about him. One is just the songwriting. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, he's a Hall of Fame songwriter. He's just amazing. But also, I always really loved his voice. Like, I love the way he would sing. You would just get this sense that he really felt these songs, you know? And that he wasn't just, you know, going out there and doing it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and what you say too is really interesting. I would like to read more about this. You know, I always want to understand the context of the times when these songs were written and released. And like you said, it's hard for people necessarily today to really understand how divided this country was in the era of the Vietnam War.
Exactly.
And there was, you know, the sort of peace and love movement, and there was a feeling from people who actually served or family members of people who served that they were somehow against the troops. You know, they were against all of this. You know, over time we've all sort of reconciled all this and realized that's not really the case. But at the time it was pretty divisive for the country, and people thought the country was going to sort of fall apart. You know, not only that, but then the various assassinations that were happening and all of that. It was really a very very difficult time for this country. And so the idea that people who had a stronger connection to the Vietnam War and the troops and the people who served, they couldn't really relate to, you know, what was going on, sort of like the hippie movement, which was the predominant sort of musical movement at the time.
The Grateful Dead was not for them.
Right. But they could get into a band like CCR, even though they were writing about the misjustice or the inequities that were happening at the time in some of the same ways, but maybe in a more direct and direct way that people could really relate to and connect to, more so than probably what was happening in sort of like psychedelia and things like that.
Absolutely.
Right. You know?
So, yeah, absolutely.
If anything, they may have had more impact when we look back, right?
When they hit with Proud Mary in 1968, it kicked off a run of the following singles: Born on the Bayou, Bad Moon Rising, Lodi, Green River, Commotion, Down on the Corner, Fortunate Son, Traveling Band, Who'll Stop the Rain, Up Around the Bend, run through the jungle, yeah, looking out my back door. Have you ever seen the rain? Hey, tonight, Sweet Hitchhiker and Someday Never Comes. That was within 4 years.
It's insane.
Arguably some of the greatest American rock and roll songs ever written.
Oh, completely. They are a nominee for sure for the greatest American rock band.
And yet, in this book, there's a story when they are inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. John Fogerty has them all come, his brother included,
yes,
Tom,
yes,
and Stu Cook, and you know, the whole band. And then the day of the show, he decides they're not going to play with him, and he plays with an all-star backing band instead.
Yeah.
He did that. All their families were there.
Yeah.
All their children and grandchildren. And he said, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to go out there with Springsteen and like a couple of other guys as my backup.
Right.
Group.
Right.
So it was terrible.
How deep do, how?
I mean, it's, you know, obviously it's worth a long discussion or, you know, a week of shows or a few days of shows or
it,
something. But
it is. But the thing you said that I really think is important as we sit here today in 2019 is, and probably the greatest trick that John Fogerty pulled was this is music that honestly can unite us. Like it, they have, yep, fans across the political spectrum. Right. And even though they like Fortune Son is held up as this masterpiece, which it is,
mm-hmm,
of, you know, in being, and in calling out sort of the politicians and the moneyed class and, you know, the draft dodgers and all that. But over time, I think everybody's come to accept that, you know, that it was really messed up. And so they're one of these bands that I think you can find fans of them from all walks of life,
yep,
you know, and, mm-hmm, there's really something to be said for that.
Absolutely. In this book, if you believe what's written, the band would play the basic tracks and John Fogerty would go in and do all the overdubs and all the background vocals and all the harmonies and produce the thing himself. And he worked himself down to the bone.
Yeah. And then we haven't really talked about, we will save this for when we play more of their music and stuff like that, but just also the incredible sound they got.
Oh my God. I don't
know how we, you know, did it. Was unbelievable. So
it makes the hair on your arm stand up when you hear some of those guitar riffs,
and,
man.
And you know, Echo Park Jimmy makes fun of us for a lot of things, but one of them is sort of like our attachment to Americana,
yeah,
and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But you know, this is kind of like where that all started,
know,
you know?
It's true. It's, you know, it really is. Yeah. He invented, right, a lot of genres. So anyway, yeah, pick that book up if you want an unvarnished look.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot from Tom and the other guys, but hey, you
I'm
know,
excited.
They were there.
All right. Good reading, sir. Thank you for your book reports.
Absolutely.
And now you are a proud library card carrying
I'm really excited. Yeah, I can
member.
Go to the Mary Ryle Stiles Public Library of Falls Church, Virginia. Maybe I'll run into Bill Mulligan there one day. We'll see.
We'll see. All right.
Patrick's the guy sleeping in the,
very good,
the book room.
So please support your local library.
Just do that.
And please listen to the show frequently.
Every day.
Every day. Find us on all the big podcast platforms. Let us know about any books, rock books that you've been reading lately.
Any kind of books. Let me know what you're reading, folks. We need it.
Send us emails, rock@suburbspod.com, or call 612-440-1984. Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram @SuburbsPod. Please rate and review the show on iTunes. Please subscribe to the show. Please visit the website, suburbspod.com. Sam does such a great job keeping that current for us.
God bless you, Samuel.
There are show notes. There are songs we've played, all of that stuff. All right. Next week, we're going to have an interview.
Oh, I'm excited about this. We've been working hard backstage at the 9:30 Club to do interviews. So.
Speaking of Americana, we got an interview coming your way I think you're really going to like.
Yeah, it's going to dovetail nicely.
Yeah, so get ready for that. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
We'll talk to you guys next week. Through
And was there anything of value in the car?
Oh, yeah. Tape deck, some Creedence tapes, and there was a, my briefcase. Do you find in much, these stolen cars?
Sometimes. Wouldn't hold out much hope for the tape deck, though.
Or the Creedence.